This road that you are looking at is that road that it speaks of. Most archaeologists suggest this is probably the road that they're talking about, or that Luke's talking about here, that you make up the Mount of Olives. It's hard to make out. You can see a person way in the distance. That kind of gives you some perspective just how narrow this street is, even today, for a modern vehicle to go up it. It's a bit of a feat, and to watch a tour bus driver and the maneuverability, because there are actually hairpin turns, so you have the wall on both sides, and it's very, very narrow. This is a two-way street, so it's a very narrow road to get up there. You can actually see a handrail there for tourists and things like that. But when you get to the top of the Mount of Olives, which we're not talking Rocky Mountains here, so when they kind of use that term loosely. So when you get to the top, there's a view there that you have all seen hundreds of times. You've seen it probably thousands of times if you follow the news at all. And it looks like this, and this is a bit of a panoramic shot, so it's a bit deceiving in some ways. But it's that famous shot of the Golden Dome, which sits on top of the Temple Mount. The Golden Dome, run by primarily Muslims, you actually can't get onto the top unless you go through a checkpoint. The Temple Mount outside of there is run by the Jewish authorities. Obviously a hot, contested place these days. But behind the old city, you see some more modern architecture and things like this. So there's a couple things that are deceiving in this photo. One is the topography is quite deceiving because you're actually at the same level as the Dome of the Rock when you stand from the Temple Mount looking down. You'll also notice that it goes down into a valley. So first, just take in the boxes. Depending on what day or the time of day, those are like bone white. So this is at sunset, the golden hour, so that's why the hue is different. But usually they're just bright, super white. There's 10,000 plus Jewish people buried there today. There's 10,000 different tombs there, over 100,000 plus Jewish people. It's the largest Jewish cemetery in the entire world. But then as you look down, it heads into what is known as the Kidron Valley, and then it goes up to the Temple Mount. And there you can see the Eastern Wall, which is actually the wall of the Old City, which is also the wall on the Temple Mount itself. Now I'm going to zoom in. You've actually seen this image before, but I'm going to zoom in to the right of that dome real quick, and that's these two archways. Now, depending on who you read, what scholars you read, there's a lot of controversy over the name, and there's also a lot of controversy over the use of this, but these gates, it's one gate, but it's referred to as either, depending on who you read, it's either the Mercy Gate or the Golden Gate. And scholars they're always, debating on what the exact use of this gate was in the first century during the time of Jesus. Some say it was the place where the red heifer would be entered into the city. Strange enough, that's made it into the news recently. There are others who argue no, this was during the Day of the Atonement. Or Day of Atonement, they would send out the scapegoat and into the wilderness with all the sins of the people. And still others say, no, it was just primarily the access point for the priests. You'll also note that it's blocked up, and that was because of the Ottoman Empire. We've talked about that, the Muslim, during all of that, during the Middle Ages, they blocked it up. And the reason for that, you also notice there are tombs there as well, and those are Muslims buried there. So you could see how there's a lot of contention concerning this area, but not new. Since the Middle Ages, Jewish tradition has it, that's when the Messiah is going to enter through that gate. That's why they blocked it up. For a Christian, that happened in the scene we just read 2,000 years ago in the person of Jesus when he entered into the city. Now, in months before Jesus' death, he repeatedly speaks of his impending death. And that he's going to die. Peter learns quite quickly not to question that. He does question it once, you'll remember. And Jesus says to him in Matthew 16, "Get behind me, Satan." From that point forward, we don't know if Peter ever came to any kind of conclusive conviction that Jesus was somehow going to die. What we do know is he doesn't ever speak against it again. But Jesus repeatedly speaks that he's going to die. And some commentaries, even some pastors, I think said this a few years ago as well, say that the reason, that nobody would have known that Jesus, his followers certainly wouldn't have known that he was going to die. And the reason is because Jesus often spoke in very cryptic ways. But I think there's even a more straightforward kind of reason for it, and it's just denial. I think denial is the simplest answer for why they wouldn't have known. Simple denial is easier than trying to get your minds around that which is unimaginable. Denial is quite a drug. We use it for a lot of things. One of the biggest denials we live with on a daily basis is our mortality. It actually helps us get out of bed. It's an important denial. If you thought about it all the time, it would be hard to get out of bed. It's important to think about, but if you only think about your impending death all the time, that's a bit tricky to walk 2 feet in front of the others. But we all are going to face that. So we live with that constant denial. Denial is an important thing in the stages of grief that we might go through, but denial also is used not just for things that we fear. Denial is also used for things that we couldn't ever dream of, or even that which we don't want to bear, including a lost dream. And so we have here Peter also probably in denial because of his lost dream, even the crowds as well. That's not to say there wouldn't have been confusion that Jesus was going to head towards death, but Jesus' ultimate purpose in this scene that we just read was to subvert their ideas. Their ideas concerning power, their ideas concerning the ways that his kingdom would move, their ideas concerning weakness, and even their ideas of what they want in their life in terms of their dreams. But to do that, he uses, strangely, some symbolism. Some of the symbolism is militaristic. He is going in the city, obviously, in a victory parade, similar to an emperor that would enter into the city, either the city that he was about to conquer or the city that he had just conquered. And there's not as much hoopla in Luke's, but when you take them all into view, you have the coats being laid down in front of Jesus, you have the cheering crowds, you have the palm branches, which are like banners, as Peter mentioned, it was the adults doing that, not just the children. And I think we forget that sometimes, that they were speaking of a king that was about to come in and conquer this city. And there was great excitement, anticipation, the air was thick. And yet, as we know, he doesn't arrive on a war horse, he arrives on a donkey. Even worse, he arrives on a foal of a donkey. Just to maybe give a cultural equivalent to what a horse represented in the ancient Near East. I know you know this, but it represented two things at the same time. It represented, like, maybe the cultural equivalent would be like, if he rode in on a horse, it'd be like him riding in on a Mercedes G-Wagon in terms of status that had military capability. I found out, learned this week, there is such a thing. Mercedes actually made a war-equipped vehicle. So it both was a horse was a symbol of not only status but military capability, right? Jesus, he rolls in on a Fiat, right? And Fiats are terrible cars. They're the worst cars manufactured, in my opinion, one of, up there with American-made GM products. But that's neither here nor there. So it's not just that he rolled in on a Fiat. He rode on the worst Fiat, which is the Fiat Multipla. We don't see many of these here today. If you see one, let me know, because those are crazy cars. They look like almost like the Pope Mobile, doesn't it? You see these primarily overseas. But I heard the Pope actually upgraded to a Mercedes G-Wagon nonetheless. But no fears, it's a EV, so I guess that you're allowed to do that if you're the Pope. My point in all of this is, well, if you take into consideration what he rides in on, and then you remember who's following him, Luke tells us it's his disciples, which he's very specific when he's talking about the 12. He's not just talking about the 12. He's talking about the crowds that followed Jesus, which included not only this group of misfits, these guys who didn't make it into the right schools, tradesmen and fishermen, it also included. So he doesn't have behind him an army. He has behind him these people who didn't make it in life, and he has in that crowd probably women as well, which you wouldn't do if you were trying to come into the city as an emperor or something like this. And I think we miss that, just how it was a true act of performance art. In one sense, he's enacting a parody. And I think it goes lost. It certainly had to have gone lost on the crowd, just how much he was trolling them in one sense or another. With that crowd, what he rides in on that town on. And I think probably I don't think we would have appreciated it then either. I mean, a lot of this is retrospect. But maybe the clearest sign that this wasn't actually a triumphant entry is that moment when he gets to the wall and he says this. they're going to dash you. He's speaking about the Romans, of course. They're going to dash you. He's speaking about his people. They're going to dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls, and they're not going to leave one stone on top of the other. And I always wondered, I still wonder, if Peter heard him say it. Like if Peter heard Jesus amongst all the noise, right? The celebration, the anticipation, the joy, the singing, probably his own anticipation about what's about to happen. Did he experience a kind of cognitive dissonance between the noise, the parade, the victory songs, and then seeing him with tears? Because he's not saying it in anger. He's weeping as he's saying those words. Or did the noise crowd that out? And I've learned a few things as a pastor over the years. And this is what I think might be going on. And it's that people will hear what they want to hear when it comes to Jesus. So maybe it just went right past them. And people will see what they want to see when it comes to this Jesus. Jesus' final week in Jerusalem was a provocative act, not just that parade. In Matthew 21, we hear that he arrives, right, in just like in the scene we just read, and he's driving out these folks who are selling things. I'm just going to give you a few different passages from the other Gospels, which speak of him driving out the money changers and driving out these livestock sellers. In Matthew, he says he overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those who are selling doves. Very early on in John's Gospel, he says he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts. Obviously, Luke hints at this as well. In fact, all four Gospels mention this very thing. And the pigeons and the doves that were sold were the offering of the poor. They were the acceptable offering of the poor. And it was for those who either they couldn't bring their own livestock because they couldn't afford to bring their own livestock, or when they actually got to the city after all of those travels, they wouldn't be able to afford a lamb. They wouldn't be able to afford any of that. So they would, of course, the acceptable offering was the pigeon, the dove. But I want you to know that at every turn, they would have been ripped off. At every turn, it was like your worst. I mean, if you're a parent, you go to like a what are those called when you go to a visiting, when you're traveling and you tourist trap. It's like that on steroids with religion all mixed in, right? Like at every turn, those travelers would have got ripped off. Not only in terms of they would have been charged exorbitant fees for those livestock, those animals, even those pigeons and doves, but even when they went to go exchange, right, the criminal charge that they would have had for those travelers in terms of exchanging money, this is actually a coin that was found by a young girl from that era, but to exchange your money, if you held, you know, Roman coins, there was only one coin you could use on that Temple Mount. So the criminal rate that was charged in terms of that exchange rate. And I find myself over the years less and less enraged at the predators, because people are going to people, and they've been doing that since Genesis 3. Yet it's gross and it's disgusting. And I find their acts gross and disgusting. But I find myself more drawn to the travelers themselves, because if you understood to travel there, not only you could get around, Paul covered a lot of ground in the first century, so this idea that they couldn't travel in the ancient world, that's not true. But when you did travel, it was risky, it was dangerous. And then you're poor on top of that, right? So at every turn, even that was a risk. And then you get to the place that you've been told your entire life is where God lives, and you can be near to this God. And then you get there, the one place where God is, and these folks hold an entire monopoly over your entire experience and the amount of control that they had. And I think we forget who these people are. I think we think of like these health, wealth, gospel preachers who are ripping people off. These were the Sadducees. This whole group were a group of basically the elite business people of that town. If you go to Jerusalem, those were all the wealthy people doing this to these folks. And I think this is where that image, basically if you got there and you couldn't afford it, you had no way to practice your faith. You were on the wrong side of a tremendous amount of power and a tremendous amount of wealth. And I think about just how lucrative a grift that temple worship was at the time. And I think this is where the image of Jesus making that whip, flipping over tables, and is angry, that image of him, deeply angry, can cloud out how compassionate that scene actually is and the compassion he's having on his people in that moment. Perhaps Peter didn't see that. Perhaps Peter saw it as the first act of a long war, the first act of what they were about to do, take over the government, take over the temple, put it in the hands of the rightful owners. Now, we might laugh at Peter making that mistake, but we're not that different. I grew up as a Christian my entire life. And for as long as I've been a Christian, Christians, depending on what tradition and depending on what angle you're taking, but I've heard Christians use battle language to talk about a lot of things, metaphors for ministry, metaphors for the way we should approach, you know, politics, metaphors for the way in which we should, you know, battle for the hearts and minds of children when it comes to education. And on some levels, it makes sense, because when Jesus mentions his kingdom, that comes with military overtones. Paul speaks of the armor of God. He speaks of battling against darkness in our lives. But as Christians, if you look, take in the whole history of Christians, we are tempted to take those images, to overextend those images, and use them to justify pretty much anything. And we've done just that. Everything from the individual sort of bravado, chest-thumping, faux Christian manliness and strength. But if we want to see Jesus as just that, a fighter wielding a whip, inviting us to take up ours for his cause, we will do it. We've always done it. We've been doing it since 325 AD. Now, it might be on a battlefield. Strange enough, that's also been in the news. It might be there where we'll use that language. It might be in a boardroom. It might be on the steps of a Capitol building. It might even be in a school board. And really sadly, it might be in a place like this, a church, a pulpit. But the Spirit's always the same. And it's we wield the world's power to gain more of it. It's always the same fruit. If we can turn Jesus' actions in the temple into a justification for the militarization of our faith, we will do it. We've always done it. But if that's what we're after, at some point this Jesus is going to really disappoint you. And he's really going to disappoint me. In fact, he disappointed these crowds. I always find it strange. You know, he comes in, everybody's excited. Everybody's hanging on every word. You find another where Jesus goes in after clearing it and he starts teaching. Everybody's hanging on to every single word he is saying. But then unrest starts to build. And then the mobs want him executed because he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's not taking it over. And so the authorities, they see an opening. They hand Jesus over to the Romans, and they have him indicted on charges of insurrection. But then Pilate comes and questions him, and Jesus only ever makes claims concerning his spiritual authority. He never makes claims that he's going to take over the temple. He never makes claims that he's going to take over the government, which is what a Messiah should have done. So then, in a very revealing move, Pilate then goes to the crowd and gives them a choice. Do you want this Jesus to be released, who has said he doesn't want to take over? He's never said he wants to take over. Or do you want Barabbas released, who, by the way, was in jail because he took part in a violent insurrection? And it says it here in Matthew. Which of the two, Pilate says, do you want me to release? And who do they all say unanimously? Yeah, we want Barabbas. Effectively, the crowd was saying, Jesus, you can keep your kingdom come. We want ours now. And we want that dream now. Now, this might really sound contradictory, given that we Christians like to use militaristic language when it comes, battle language when it comes to our faith. Christians, we also really like a good martyr narrative. We like a good victim narrative. Now, Christians will talk like they don't like victimology and victim. The irony is we do like victim language and we do like martyr language. There are some who grew up in the faith that relish the fact that we live in a godless nation, that relish the fact that we live in a nation that hates children and doesn't know the difference between male and female. And they even relish the fact that they can't find a gospel preacher within a 500-mile radius of them. And it's not only that. There are some outlets, I've listened to them more recently, that say daily that Christians are but a generation from having their faith taken away from them. The Christians are a generation from your faith and my faith being illegal. 15 years ago, the people who were going to do that were going to be Sharia law. More recently, it was going to be the gays and the transgender who are going to take our faith away from us and make it illegal. Even more recently, it's the immigrants who are going to do that, but that gets a little messy because many of those immigrants are Catholic as well as Pentecostal, but we won't talk about that. And then, of course, you have your just typical garden variety. Marxism is going to make our faith illegal. Each of those are an example of real moral pressure, real fear, moral panic. But let's entertain every one of them, not one by one. I'll let you talk about which one of those is the greater threat. My point is I'm going to take each of them at face value. Every single one of them is a real threat to your faith and my faith. Your faith may indeed be illegal 15 years from now. Even if that were the case, our response to any of them is still wrong when in fear we reject Jesus and his ways. And we start crying for Barabbas. The persecution narrative, the martyr narrative, has always justified the militarization of our faith. And it turns out, I have found, that Christians, we really like a good martyr story, but nobody wants to die. Nobody wants to lose. We want a revolutionary. We want a fighter. We want a savior with a sword, a whip will do. What do we have convulsive allergic reactions to? The cross. We do not like the cross. We do not like to lose. And we certainly do not want to suffer. And in a culture that is teaches to protect everything we have at all costs, we slowly lose sight of this Jesus. And in that fear, we even will align ourselves with those who have nothing to do with him. And we have. Meaning, when we feel like we're losing, meaning when we feel like we're losing influence in the world, when we feel like we're losing what we once had as a nation, and I'll let you talk about what we've lost, it makes us really defensive. Or even the smallest admissions you cannot make. One of those might be something like racism. I grew up in the inner city. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that everything in this world is racist, racist this, racist that. But we're not allowed to admit that even the painful reality of racism might exist, because that, of course, will unravel anything. So we can't even be honest about our world. But underneath that fear is something deeper. And the Bible has a word for that, and it's called a stiff-necked people. And it's not when we just don't accept others around us. It's when we do not receive this God, and we do not receive his ways. And it happens when we cling too tightly. It happens when we cling too tightly to our stories. It happens when we cling too tightly to our narratives. It happens when we cling too tightly to this world. And we all do it. I do it. Jesus frees us of this fear, this pressure. In him we are secure. We don't have to grasp. We don't have to defend. We don't even have to fight. We're free to listen. We're even free to confess what is true. We're free to love our neighbors. We're even free to love those who hate us and even want to do harm to us with great humility and great courage. And Jesus, he sparked a revolution that day, flipping those tables, entering into the Temple Mount, but not by taking up his arms against Rome. Instead, he took up arms, if you will. He turned inward. And I don't mean spiritually. I mean he confronted the very religious people who kept people from God. He wasn't rejecting worship. He wasn't even rejecting the temple. He wasn't even rejecting, in one sense, the institution. He was reforming it. He was renewing it. He was restoring it ultimately in himself. And when it was all over, you'll notice he didn't keep the whip. You know, Indiana Jones, he has that holster where he keeps his whip, and he has an adventure hat. He doesn't keep his whip on that holster on his waist. He drops it. And he drops it because his movement was not going to progress via force. It was going to progress via a gift, so that all would have access to God. And what followed, and we're heading towards this week, what followed was his road into darkness. But there would be somebody who would pick up a whip. But it wouldn't be for Jesus' cause. And it wouldn't be to defend his cause. It would be to split his back wide open Jesus says to each of us that we have to take up our cross and to follow him, which leaves us with a choice. And this choice we do not make on our own. This choice is done in his strength. And the question and the choice is always the same. Which end of the whip are you and me as his followers going to be on? And in one sense, the question hasn't changed. Who do you actually want? Do you want Barabbas? Or do you want this Jesus, which comes with his ways? Would you please pray with me? Our Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God, you are the God of the cross. And we stand at the front of this week where everything, including this week, including this story, it looks so familiar, where we think we see clearly. And yet, like Peter and so many in that crowd, we do not see you. God, you come not in power, in lowliness you come, in weakness, not to conquer, but to undo. And we confess we want the horse, if we're honest. We want the victory that actually looks like an actual victory. That's what we want. Not the suffering stuff, certainly not the cross stuff, certainly not the follow me stuff. We want Barabbas, not you. God, we cling to our fear. We cling to our control. We cling to our stories. We cling to our narratives about how the world must be saved, how our lives will be saved. Yet you weep. You weep as you enter, refusing our ways, choosing the cross instead, so that in your death we might know true peace, that in your death we might know true life. So we ask that you would undo us, undo what we grasp, undo what we defend, what we can't bear to lose, and teach us again to follow, not with a whip, but with a cross, not by grasping, but receiving, not by conquering or winning, but by loving, courageously, with humility, even here, and even when it costs us. We pray this in the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, in the name of the Holy Spirit, and all of God's people say,